in the back seat and he'd drop him off at home first. No, too obvious. He'd think of something. Janice was kneeling, putting on her white beach jacket. She wrapped her yellow towel around her waist, and when she stood up, one long dark leg showed through the slit.
Hey, Jan,
a girl called out.
Where are you going?
A stocky girl in a red bathing suit ran up to them, waving her arms. She was out of breath.
I have a headache, Janice said coldly.
Hey, who is this? The friend drawled, her grin verifying what he caught glimpses of in every mirror or storefront he passed. Tanned and muscular from his long days laboring in the sun, he now had the body of a man.
Norman from Oil, a friend of...
Janice hesitated, then added,
Mine.
The friend giggled and rolled her eyes.
Some headache, Jan. I should be in such pain, she laughed, gesturing limply toward a skinny boy in plaid shorts who was hurrying toward her.
Jan and Norman, this is Peter Slavin from some place called Dartmouth. Peter, Janice Miller, my roommate with a terrible headache, and this is Norman, her very obvious symptom.
And I'm Kit Neal,
she laughed, eagerly grabbing his hand.
Careful, he warned. It might be catching.
You mean contagious, Janice said through a taut smile.
God, I hope so, Kit howled.
Actually, I'm the remedy 9 out of 10 doctors recommend.
He leaned close to Kit with a sly wink. Smooth as smooth could be, this was the big time and he was on a roll.
Oh, God,
Janice groaned, slapping his arm.
A blatant case of muddled metaphors, Slavin said, thumping a fresh pack of Marlboros on his fist.
He glanced at Slavin. Meta what? Whores? Spores? Well, the girls certainly didn't look offended, though it seemed they should be. Janice and Kit whispered a moment, then said they were going down to the bathhouse to dress. Kit told Norm to wait, and then they could all go into the hotel together. Before he could say anything, Janice grabbed his arm and pressed it against her chest.
Norman doesn't have his ID, she said quickly.
That's all right,
Slavin said, lighting his cigarette and Norm's with an engraved lighter that he stabbed in the air now to punctuate his plan.
He waits out here. We get a pitcher, he comes in, orders ginger ale, chugs it, and voila, the man's got himself a glass.
Norm hurried back to the car to put on his pants and sneakers, and then he ran down to the beach.
Where's my hot dog?
Benji demanded, as Norm snatched his shirt from the blanket.
Look, Benji, just shut up and listen, he panted. I gotta do something that's very important, and you wouldn't understand, so I'm not going to go into the details here.
Damn, he'd misbuttoned the shirt, so he started over.
I won't be gone that long. I'll be right back as soon as I figure this out. Don't talk, just listen. Here's some money. Go get the hot dog. But don't leave here. Wait for me, you hear me? Just wait.
Where are you going?
Benji tried to grab his arm, but Norm scrambled up the incline.
Hotel!
He called back over his shoulder.
What for?
Benji shouted. Robert Haddad hadn't left the couch all night. Thankfully, the party seemed to be fizzling. Corinne, one of Astrid's girlfriends from the wire plant, sank down heavily beside him and yawned into her cigarette smoke. She was a skinny woman, heavily made up, with an intricately coiled hairdo. Like the rest of them in their slutty clothes, she drank, smoked, talked too much, and sat too close.
So how's business?
She gulped at the end of her yawn and poured more beer into her glass. Haddad ignored her. He watched Astrid, who stood by the hutch, talking to her manager from the wire plant.
That's terrible, she cried with a poke in his ribs.
He was a tall, balding man whose wife was divorcing him. He put his hand on the wall over Astrid's head and leaned toward her. Haddad was sure he was drunk. Haddad tugged his shirt cuffs down over the tufts of hair on his wrists. Astrid admired tall, slim, blonde men, as well she might, being so fair, so beautiful herself. Before her, he had never known happiness. Just the sight of her roused this ache, this pride that all that shimmering, scented softness was his. His breath quickened with the dizzying rush of giddiness and fear that was more than sexual. It was mystical, a religious experience. She was the core of his being, the purity and goodness that once had been only words.
Because of her, he was becoming a moral man. Of course, there had been a few missteps lately. Aberrations so alien, so reproachful, they only reinforced his yearning for decency in all things. Someone turned off a light and lit the candle on the windowsill. Didn't they see how close to the curtains the flame was burning? Just a gust of wind would turn this place into an inferno. Were insurance men the only ones alert to such dangers? He started to get up, then changed his mind. She would berate him in front of her friends if he blew it out and turned the light back on. She would say he was trying to spoil everyone's fun, and she would be right. He was tired. They were getting louder and drunker, and he wanted them to leave. A woman shrieked, then stumbled past him toward the bathroom. Her boyfriend banged on the door.
"I gotta pee, too," he whined.
Couples danced in the flickering darkness. He leaned forward. Astrid and her manager were dancing. Their swaying shadow loomed across the ceiling. He tried to swallow. Business was lousy, and the main office continued to hound him. And tonight, dressing for the party, she had again mentioned getting a job as a hostess in a cocktail lounge. It wasn't the money, she had explained, when he said he'd sell more policies. No, it was the glamour she missed, having a reason to dress up fancy like this every night. She needed something that forced her to be cheerful and funny. She wanted to hear people laugh.
"I miss that, Bobby," she had said, looking at his reflection in the mirror as she smoothed her yellow brocade dress over her hips. "I need that. I'm a very outgoing person."
This morning he'd gotten a letter from Sam Vermoyle, who wanted his policy sent to him at Applegate Hospital. There was no policy. He'd never sent that premium, or any others in the last 6 months, into the main office. Thinking that Vermoyle had been too plowed to even remember signing the contracts, he'd given the money to Astrid. She had probably bought that dress with it, the very dress that was glued against the manager's body. Corinne shook his arm. She wanted to dance, too, she said, pulling him to his feet. She told him to kiss her, and they'd make Astrid jealous, but he just shuffled clumsily to the music. She was kissing his neck. She wanted to give him a hickey. Astrid would love that, she said.
"I can't stay late. I told Astrid," she murmured. "I gotta meet this guy first thing in the morning. He's something. Hey, you're in business. You know him? Omar Duval? He's an entrepreneur. Hey, what's the matter?"
Haddad lunged at the manager, who was kissing Astrid.
"Cut it out, Bobby!"
Astrid screamed as his fist bit into the man's mouth. The man reeled back, dazed, squinting as he lurched clumsily at Haddad, who struck him in the stomach. The man sank to his knees, then lay on the floor. Astrid tore at his arms as he kicked the crumpled manager's back. Someone pulled him away. He just stood there with weighted arms at his sides and closed eyes while Astrid screamed at him.
"Come on, honey," Corinne kept saying. "Big deal, isn't he? Big deal, kicking a man when he's down. I hate you. I hate this place. I hate everything about you."
Haddad went into the bedroom and closed the door. He sat on the bed and whimpered into his palms. A door opened and closed. Voices called somber goodbyes. Someone was picking up glasses and closing windows. When he came out, the room was empty. The rug was still rolled up against the wall. The light was on under the bathroom door. He stood by it a minute, then moaned against the door jamb.
"I'm sorry, baby. I'll make it up to you, I promise. Next week, you can have another party, bigger even than..."
"She ain't in here," a woman said. Then the toilet flushed and the door opened. Corinne came out, spraying her hair.
"She went to the lake."
"Geez, you look shitty. Why don't you sleep? Astrid'll cool off, and then she'll come home dragging her tail behind her," she assured him, with a quick glance in the mirror and one last spurt of spray. When the last couple left the beach, Benji grabbed the blanket and ran to the car. He could wait in here. He opened the windows, reassured by the music and the voices from the hotel that Norm was close by. Soon he had to close the window because of all the mosquito bites he was getting. Now the glass kept fogging up. He doodled on the steamy windshield, then on the side windows and the ones in back. He wiped them clear with a blanket, then began to exhale rapidly. As soon as they steamed up again, he started over, this time writing swears in the tiniest letters he could make. "Fuck you, Norm." Norm is an asshole. Norm is a dink. He paused, wondering what the difference was. Well, an asshole would be a real obnoxious jerk, and a dink would be a creep who was scared of his own shadow and so afraid to do anything that he was always spoiling it for everyone else. He was a dink. And by that standard, Norm was an asshole. Well, sometimes. Norm had never been a dink, but then again, he himself had never been an asshole, which seemed like a good thing right now, like something to be proud of. Every now and again, cars would arrive and people would go into the hotel. A man and a woman were coming down the wide wooden stairway now. Benji ducked as they got into the next car and then left. A few minutes later, another car pulled into the lot with its radio blasting. Three women got out. They were laughing so hard they had to lean against the car with their legs crossed as if they were trying not to wet their pants. The last woman emerging from the back seat was Astrid Haddad.
"Help!" she cried halfway out. "I'm stuck!"
"Here, you're not stuck, you're just drunk," her friend said, giggling, pulling her the rest of the way out.
"I am not,"
Astrid protested as she teetered in a stiff little circle. The women linked arms. An uneasy feeling came over him as they bumped into one another on their way up the stairs to the hotel. Men were the perilous ones, not women. It was women who kept him safe, who always knew the limits. He lay back down on the seat and stared up at the bright stars and the moon for as long as he could without blinking. The record so far was 2 minutes. The windshield steamed up again. His eyes closed. He was asleep. 2 hours had passed, but it seemed he had been sleeping for only a little while. He sat up and rolled down the window. The moon had risen over the lake, trailing a luminous path across the black water. The crickets were louder. There were only a few cars left in the lot. He opened the door, sighing as he urinated onto the gravel from inside the car. The car Astrid had come in was gone. What if Norm had gone home with someone else and left him here? He ran up the steps to the hotel veranda, which was lined with rocking chairs. The floorboards creaked underfoot as he crept from window to window, trying to find Norm. These were the dining room windows, but he could see only a few people inside. Somewhere a piano was playing. Voices swelled now as he rounded the far corner of the building. He peered through the parted curtains in the long windows. There was a dimly lit smoky lounge with a three-piece band playing. A couple was dancing, their arms around each other's neck. The mirror behind the bar was cracked down the middle. Fishing nets and mounted game fish hung from the walls. He moved to the last window. From here he could see most of the tables. People in this end of the room were standing and clapping as they sang, "So drink, chug-a-lug, 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 so drink, chug-a-lug," while a guy drank a mug of beer in what looked like one quick swallow. Finished, he banged down the empty mug. It was Norm. Norm, blinking and wiping foam from his mouth with the back of his hand. Norm, standing now with his hands over his head to acknowledge the cheers. His brother, Norm, drunk and sinking heavily back into a chair. A girl with long blonde hair kept poking his arm, but every time she said anything, Norm just laughed. A guy with a dark bushy beard had strutted over to their table, and now he was draining his mug dry while everyone chanted and clapped. Now Benji noticed the chubby girl who had been timing the guy with a stopwatch. Norm hoisted his mug, gesturing for a refill. The blonde girl said something, then got up and left. Norm raised the dripping mug to his lips, and Benji ran back to the car. He climbed into the back and curled up on the seat, enshrouding himself in the blanket. He slept so soundly in the fuzzy darkness that it was not the sluggish voices that roused him as the front doors opened, but the sudden glare of the dome light filtering through the brown wool. The doors closed. He started to sit up, then lay back down. Astrid was behind the wheel, not Norm. He could hear Norm, but he couldn't see him.
"Oh, you poor thing. Just put your head right there, you poor thing."
She started the car. Norm struggled to speak.
"Get one. Go, gun. Go."
Suddenly Norm sat up and opened the door.
"Gotta go get..."
He waved toward the beach.
"All your friends are gone," Astrid said. "They left, honey. They left you all alone in there, but don't worry. I'm going to take good care of you, sweetie."
The wet, prickly wool rubbing Benji's chin was all the shame he felt. How could Norm have let this happen? Especially Norm, of all people. Norm, who couldn't bear humiliation, reduced to this incoherent babble. He lay perfectly still. When they got home, he would pretend he had been sleeping all this time. He only prayed that Astrid wouldn't turn Norm into their mother. This could be a double cross. How many times had they appeased and coddled his father just to get him out of the house or off the streets? She pulled onto the lake road with the back of Norm's head bobbing against his window.
"I'll get you home safe and sound. Now don't you worry about a thing, sweetie," she murmured.
She was so short she had to peer between the dashboard and the top of the wheel to see the road that wended in and out with the shoreline. The tires squealed on the curve and Norm groaned.
"You okay, sweetie? You look kind of peaked," she said,
and Norm grunted.
"How about if I just pull in here a minute? Actually, I'm feeling kind of loopy myself."
She turned off the engine and rolled down her window, then fanned herself with her hand.
"Whew, hot in here. You okay?" "Here," she said, reaching past him. "Let me get your window down. The air'll perk you right up."
Now Norm's head hung back out the open window. He was gasping.
"What's the matter, sweetie?"
She touched his face.
"You okay? Don't scare me now. Just take it easy."
He moaned.
"You're what? You're gonna what?" she asked. "Here, then. Let's loosen you up some."
Norm said something and she giggled. His belt buckle clinked.
"So you can breathe better," she murmured.
There was a zipping sound.
"There. How's that feel?"
She kissed him.
"Feels good, huh?"
She held his face and began to kiss him again.
"It's okay," she kept saying. "I'm going to help you, sweetie. Don't you worry. It's okay."
He couldn't tell if Norm was trying to hug her or push her away, but his arms kept slipping off her shoulders. He was panting, or maybe crying. Benji raised his head to see. Astrid sat back.
"God, I hate bringing you home like this," she sighed. "Your mother's gonna kill you, you poor thing."
Norm's agitation increased.
"This with the thing with Benji," he cried,
pawing at the windshield as if to part curtains.
"Where's Benji?"
"Benji's home, sweetie."
"Benji's home?"
He looked at her.
"Huh?"
"Yep. Sound asleep in his nice warm bed."
"Okay, good. Okay."
He belched and laid his head back on the window well.
"Benji's home. Good."
Astrid raised her arms and pulled her shirt over her head.
"Come here, sweet baby,"
she said, sliding next to Norm. Benji could see her white shoulders, her bent head over the squeaking seat. He couldn't see his brother, but he could hear the sounds he was making.
"There, baby, there," she moaned. "Go ahead. Oh, okay, here. Try this one now."
The smacking, slurping sounds continued along with Astrid's moans. His brain was on fire as he eased onto the floor, cocooned in the blanket. Flames, red and orange flames in his brain, in his eyes. Norm hiccuped loudly, and Astrid sat up. Benji stared up at her breasts, hanging big and white in the moonlight, just inches from his brother's face.
"I'm gonna,
Norm groaned.
"Gonna what?"
Astrid gasped, trying to get her shirt back on. Not gonna any longer, he knew from the hot, gagging spew of it. Norm already had. The car reeked of vomitous liquor.
"Shit,"
she cried, hitting the wheel.
"Shit, shit, shit. That's it. I'm done. I'm through. I never should have come here. Never, never, never."
"I'm sorry,"
Norm muttered, as his head fell back against the open window again.
"Wake up, Norm. Don't do this. Damn it. Wake up," she said.
But he was so deeply asleep that he began to snore. She started the car and drove back to Atkinson, crying all the way. Curled on the floor, Benji felt every bump jolt up his spine. The car slowed, then turned, and he knew by the passing trees and roof lines that he was almost home. The minute she pulled into the driveway, she turned off the motor and the headlights and got out of the car. Nauseated, Benji pushed the blanket off his face. He looked up to see Astrid at Norm's window. She kept whispering his name, trying to wake him up.
Shit,
she gasped, as Klubok's dog began to growl from the lilac bushes behind her. She froze, and Benji realized she was staring at him. Without a word, she stepped out of sight. After a moment, he sat up and looked around. She had delivered them to the wrong driveway. She was running down the street with her high heels in her hands.
Norm! Norm! He whispered, shaking his shoulder. You gotta wake up! We're in Klubok's driveway!
The white Cadillac was parked out front, which meant that Omar had spent another night on the couch. Norm's eyes opened.
There's Benji. Good. That's good. Good.
He smiled, then with a heavy sigh, closed his eyes again. He begged Norm to wake up. He shook his arm, nudged his head, thumped the top of the seat, warning of the trouble they were going to be in. Bad enough he was drunk and had thrown up all over the front seat of their mother's car, but being in Klubok's driveway, well, that was the far greater offense.
You're gonna get killed, Norm!
And now it hit him. So was he. He opened the door and ran toward the house, not realizing until he got to the steps that Klubok's dog was chasing him. He grabbed the dog's collar and, running in a crouch, dragged him back to the bushes, ordering him back in there.
Stay, 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 he prayed, as he raced back to the car and tried again to rouse Norm, whose stupor had deepened.
He looked at the parallel driveways. All he had to do was back straight out of Klubok's onto the street, turn slightly, then head into their own driveway. That might even wake Norm up enough to get him inside. He just prayed the damn dog stayed where he was and didn't start barking. He got behind the wheel and turned the key, wincing with the thundering engine. He shifted into reverse, and the car jerked back. Panicking, he tried to get it into park again, but the car lurched forward. He jammed his foot onto the pedal, the wrong pedal. It was the gas pedal, he realized as the car surged forward, turning right into the lilac bushes. Branches cracked.
No!
He cried with the sickening bump. He hit the brake, shifted, then turned off the engine and ran into the house. He climbed into bed and lay sobbing with the pillow over his head. In the morning, Alice's eyes shot open to the commotion downstairs. She threw back the sheets and sat up, trembling. She had overslept. The priest would be here soon. Her mother was screaming. She ran around the room, trying to get ready. Norm's voice, congested and quivering, rose from the kitchen.
I said I'm sorry. It wasn't my fault. I can't help it if I got food poisoning.
Food poisoning?
Her mother cried.
You were drunk. You were so goddamn drunk you plowed into Klubok's lilac bushes and killed their goddamn dog. You think I killed it on purpose? I was sick, Mom. Honest to God, I got food poisoning.
Food poisoning? You don't even remember what happened.
Because I must have passed out.
How could you do that? How could you do that to me? To yourself? Jesus Christ, Norm, after all you've seen, after all we've been through?
We had those lousy hot dogs. Ask Benji, that's what it was.
Benji,
she scoffed.
According to him, he slept all night. He barely remembers coming home. See, he's probably got food poisoning, too.
I don't want to hear about food poisoning.
Well, you should at least check him. I mean, what if he's in a coma or something?
Don't say it again. Don't. You hear me, mister? Because now I want the truth.
That is the truth.
What a mess, Alice groaned as she clipped her stocking into her garter belt. Poor Benji. He liked the dog even more than the Klubok did. She wondered if Omar was down there in the middle of all that yelling. What on earth did he want here? She wondered as she brushed her hair. Did he think this was the way families were supposed to be?
Didn't he know that in normal homes the sofa and easy chairs matched, and the lamps had shades, and the windowsill plants grew in clay pots, not rusting coffee cans, and a family's only anxiety sitting down to dinner might be bones in the fish, the boiled heat of gravy, or a nick in the glass rim, and not the sting of their mother's gasp when the phone rang, fearing another bill collector's ultimatum, or worse, their weeping father's thin, wet love, his slurred vows to return as lethal a blade as his sorrow. God, this was all so humiliating, having to go up there with a priest to beg her father for money she knew he didn't have. But her mother was convinced he was hoarding some fortune from her, as if he'd ever had a penny of his own. She slipped on her dress, then groped in the dust under the bed for her white shoes. With every wobbly step, the heels squeaked, a painful reprise of graduation night. She twisted her hair into a bun so tight it pulled her eyes into slits. She looked older now. Her father would be shocked to see how quickly time was passing, how much of her life he was missing.
"Say it!"
her mother demanded downstairs.
"Say it! Leave me alone!"
Norm moaned.
"Just leave me alone!"
She wound a cord of plastic violets around the nub of hair, then yanked it out. Damn it. What would she and a priest ever talk about on the long ride up and back? She could have taken a bus. She should have said no to him and to her mother. But she never did. Never said no. That was the trouble. Always letting people get in between the Alice they saw and the real Alice. The real Alice slept nude, touching herself under the sheets, drawing her fingers up between her legs, always stopping short, afraid of what she would find in there, even though she knew the nuns told lies and she wouldn't go crazy or suddenly bald, but afraid that she might like it too much. Last night at the A+X, Carla had insisted that was the way lesbians got started. First they did it to themselves all the time whenever they felt like it and got so much of it that they had to have it all the time that way, and only from women. Two nights ago, Carla had shown everyone the pictures Mr. Coughlin hid in his office. The pictures showed nude women kissing and fondling one another. The pictures. She shuddered, ashamed of this raw ache in her belly every time she thought of the grainy breasts pressed nipple to shriveled nipple. It frightened her to think that might be the strangeness, the unattainability that had repelled every other boy before Lester, and now, oddly enough, attracted Blue Mooney. He had even started wearing his Marine uniform to the lot now when he picked up Anthology. Everyone said it was to impress her. Oh, God. She ripped the bun out of her hair and pulled it into a ponytail. She put on bright pink lipstick and sprayed perfume down the front of her dress and up under her skirt. There was no real Alice. There couldn't be. Norm sagged over the table, his forehead braced against his fist. His shirt was wrinkled and grass-stained, and he smelled. Her mother came into the kitchen, staggering under the weight of the bulging laundry basket that she hauled onto the table. Norm winced at the thud.
"Oh, I'm so sorry," she said, leaning over him. "Forgive me, Prince Charming, I forgot."
She glanced at Alice.
"His condition. He's feeling just a little delicate this morning. Hot dogs. Too goddamn many hot dogs," she said with a poke at his back.
"Mom,"
Alice said, seeing his head tremble,
"he's sick."
"Oh, he's sick," says the princess in all her finery while the servants shuffle around her, her mother said. She was sorting the dirty clothes into piles on the floor.
"Mom, you know why I'm dressed like this," she said,
but knew from the grim flick of her mother's eyes to say no more. She made toast and sat down across from Norm. From outside came the sounds of digging, a metal shovel scraping grit and stone, rocks hitting a pile.
"Do you know what happened last night?" her mother asked.
"I heard," she muttered,
head low over the dish.
"Along with everyone else?"
Her mother was flinging clothes faster and faster now into white heaps, blue, red, and black heaps, and swirling pastel heaps that grew to table height. The smell of foot sweat and body musk burgeoned with the piles. Alice bit into the toast and chewed dryly. Her mother paused, gesturing with a pair of Norm's undershorts.
Of course, what they don't know is how thoughtful he is, how after he threw up all over my car and ruined the Klubok precious lilac bushes, crushing and killing their dog in the process, how he didn't want to disturb his mother, so he crawled into the garage where Mr. Klubok found him with his pants half off. She smiled down at Norm, whose eyes were closed. His mouth twitched. My dear, thoughtful son passed out on the dirt floor. She threw the undershorts at him, and they landed on his shoulder. He whipped them onto the floor. He turned and stared up at her.
"What can I do to make you shut up?"
Alice stopped chewing. She didn't dare swallow.
"Say you were drunk,"
her mother said through clenched teeth.
"Say it. Say you're a lousy, stinking, selfish drunk, and you're only 16 years old. Say it, and I'll shut up."
Norm hung his head.
"Say it."
She grabbed his arm and shook him.
"Say it! Say it!"
"Mom, what are you trying to do?"
he whispered, his bloodshot eyes bulging with tears.
"I told you, I'm sorry. I'm sorry."
"Say it!"
"I was drunk," he said softly.
She leaned over him.
"I'm a lousy, stinking, selfish drunk, and I'm only 16 years old,"
she commanded, her features so contorted she almost seemed to be smiling.
"Lousy, stinking, selfish drunk, and I'm only 16 years old,"
he mumbled.
"And if I don't watch it, I'll end up like my father," she hissed.
"She is," Alice thought. "She's smiling."
"And if I don't watch it, I'll end up like my father."
Alice could barely hear him. She did it, she thought.
"She always does it. Grinds and grinds and grinds until there's nothing left."
Norm stared at his coffee cup, his shoulders hunched in a strangulated sob.
"Jesus Christ,"
came her mother's muffled gasp. Her hands covered her face.
"Jesus, Jesus Christ."
The back door flew open and Omar entered, grinning, a greasy donut bag in his fist.
"Good morning, lovely people."
He shook the bag.
"Sweets to soothe our sour spirits."
Norm didn't look up. Alice watched her mother's head lift and shoulders straighten as if she were reassembling herself for Omar.
"You left. I thought you wanted to help them clean up out there, and then I saw you leave,"
her mother said with a sickening, breathless urgency.
"Well, I offered, but Harvey wants to bury the dog before his little boy sees it. Messy, I guess, all them guts and goo balls,"
he said as he arranged the donuts on a plate, taking great care with the alignment of the second tier. He tapped a jelly donut into place.
"So anyway, I went and got bakery for them and some for us. Jesse offered us coffee, but I promised I would later when I helped poor old Harve with that lilac bush. Well, patch, I guess you'd call it now. Here you go,"
he said, sliding the donuts in front of Norm, who covered his nose and mouth and looked away.
"They are very nice people,"
Omar said, going to stand by her mother at the sink, where she peered out the window from an angle so she wouldn't be seen.
"Hypocrites,"
she said under her breath.
"You should see that man's hands, the knuckles all swolled up big as butternuts. I don't know how he's out there digging. Matter of fact, I don't know how he can use a butcher knife to any degree of accuracy."
He leaned over the sink.
"Now there's a man, I bet, just looking for an investment opportunity. He's..."
"I can't have people right next door to me selling the exact same product I am,"
Marie interrupted.
"I mean, think of it. That's ridiculous."
"Whoa, whoa there. That's what I call jumping the gun, little lady. I was speaking generally. Theoretically, of course. I was about to point out, before I was so summarily interrupted, that the world is filled with Harvey Klubok, which means..."
He lifted her chin and smiled.
"Opportunity."
Her mother glanced back, her uneasy gesture drawing Omar's attention to the table.
"Well, well, well, look at you, Alice. This is the way you should be dressed every minute of every day."
He sat down and pulled the donut plate close, studying it intently. He was sweating. The cuffs on his sleeves were zigzagged with grime. He smelled stale and yeasty. He chose a donut, then examined it closely before taking a bite. He closed his eyes,
sighing as his teeth shattered the sugary glaze.
"You know," he said between bites, "Presto is looking for a model right now. They are looking for a symbol, some clean-cut, pure, wholesome, shining American face to put on their labels, a face that says,"
he stared up at the ceiling and thrust out his arms,
"buy me, use me, I am pure."
He looked at Alice.
"And you know something? You've got that look, Alice. I mean it, now don't laugh. I've been in marketing long enough to know what sells a product and what doesn't."
Her mother clutched a stiff red sock to her chest, her eyes darting between them like a bird's among a surfeit of crumbs.
"Just the other day, Jim Perrine down at the main office, I got to tell you about him, Marie, remind me sometime, a real fine gentleman. Anyway, Jim had these photos all over his desk of girls they've been considering, and I tell you this in all honesty, Alice, without an ounce of prejudice, that yours is the face they want."
He slapped his forehead with the heel of his hand.
"And it never occurred to me until now. What an oversight. Like they say, you can go around the world searching for a thing of beauty, and 9 times out of 10 you ain't gonna find it, but in one place, right in your own backyard, in your own kitchen, sitting right here at your own table. Marie, could I have paper and pen, please? I hope it's not too late. I'm going to have to write this down so it doesn't get lost among all the other memoranda swimming through my brain so fast lately that I sometimes think I am drowning in details. Thank you, Marie."
He bent over the paper, holding the pen stubbily, tightly in his fist as a child might.
"There. Consider it done."
He took another donut, then pushed the plate close to Norm.
"Have a donut. Put some food in that poor stomach of yours."
Norm grunted and shook his head. There were goosebumps on his arms.
"He can't," Marie said. "He's too hungover."
Norm covered his eyes.
"The boy's suffered enough, Marie,"
Omar said softly.
"He really should sleep some."
"He can sleep," she said, staring down at Norm, "after he cleans his mess out of my car." Groaning, Omar smiled up at Marie.
"Your mother's a hard taskmaster, son. But some day you'll be thanking her. Take my word for it."
Father Gannon was knocking on the front door. Marie rushed at Alice, pantomiming instructions. "Go to the door, quick. Go straight outside. Don't let him in. Don't. Goodbye. Hurry up." "Nosy priest," she hissed from the kitchen doorway. Alice opened the door on the young priest's eager smile.
"All set?"
he asked.
"All set,"
she said, trying to slide out quickly, but the door was being pulled wide open from inside.
"Good morning, Father,"
Omar boomed, sticking his hand out so Father Gannon had to step inside to shake it.
"I'm Omar Duval, a friend of the family's, and it's a real pleasure meeting you, Father. Mrs. Vermoyle here tells me you've taken quite an interest in her little family." "How do you do, Mr. Duval? It's nice to meet you,"
Father Gannon said, looking confused as Omar closed the door.
"We should go," Alice said, but no one seemed to hear.
"Omar, please, just Omar. Could we offer you some small repast before your mission of kindness? Some coffee? A donut?"
he urged as he led the priest into the kitchen. Alice and her mother exchanged accusing glances. Father Gannon thanked Omar, but explained that he had just eaten. He smiled when he saw Norm.
"Hey there, how's it going?"
he said, patting Norm's shoulder.
"Great, Father, just great."
Norm forced a smile and Alice cringed. There was congealed blood on his front teeth. There were yellow stains on his shirt and he reeked of stale liquor. Her bra dangled from one of the piles in this foul sea of clothing. A big black ant labored up the front of the refrigerator, slowly, slowly, while outside the sounds of digging went on and on. She wanted to die, just die.
"Sure now, Father? I used to be something of a preacher myself, visiting the jailed, the sick, and the infirm in my younger, more spiritual days, so I know it sometimes takes more than faith to fuel the soldiers in God's army."
Omar winked.
"Go ahead, have one,"
he crooned, holding out the plate. Father Gannon waved his hand.
"Really, I..." "Oh, go ahead. One's not gonna hurt,"
Omar said, laughing.
"He doesn't want one,"
Alice blurted. She looked at her mother. What was he trying to prove? That he was host here, the master?
Omar, her mother said, I don't think Father Gannon wants a donut.
Omar winced. Oh, I'm being a pest, aren't I?
No, no, Father Gannon protested, blushing. As a matter of fact, if you don't mind, I'd love to take one for later.
He picked up a jelly donut and the powdered sugar sifted onto his sleeve. Omar patted his belly.
I guess I just assume everyone's got my appetite.
He followed them to the door.
You be sure and come again, he called as they went down the walk.
The Klubox paused to watch Father Gannon turn the Monsignor's car in the driveway. In the far corner of his yard, Harvey leaned on the shovel and wiped his glistening brow. Still in her frilly housecoat, Jessie was raking broken branches into a pile. Alice looked up, surprised by a face in her mother's bedroom window. It was Benji, looking down at the burlap-covered mound next to the garage.
He seems like a real nice guy, that... What was his name, Homer?
Father Gannon said as he drove down Main Street.
Omar,
she said, low in the seat so she couldn't be seen. The jelly donut slid down the dashboard. It had already rolled off once, leaving a trail of white powder on the plush burgundy floor mat.
Homer, he said, and she didn't correct him. What was the last name again?
Duval.
Duval. Homer Duval. I have the worst time with names. Drives the Monsignor crazy.
He laughed.
In fact, first time I met your father, I thought his name was Turmoil. Sam Turmoil.
Turmoil? Was he being sarcastic? She just looked at him. All this cheeriness and gusto seemed not only forced, but oddly fragile. He was telling her everything he had done so far this morning. The 6 o'clock mass, 2 nursing home visits, 40 push-ups, a bacon and egg breakfast. He had called the chancellery to verify his appointment with the bishop, and then, with the time left over, had decided to shine his shoes. While he was at it, he figured he might as well do the Monsignor's, but somehow polish had gotten on the soles. When he left, Mrs. Arkaday had been on her hands and knees trying to scrub the black streaks from the light gray carpeting. He told her to leave it, that he'd take care of it when he got back this afternoon, but she said by then it would be too late, the stain would set. He glanced at her.
You're awfully quiet. Or am I just being my usual garrulous self?
I don't function very well in the morning, she said, wondering if garrulous meant annoying.
I was like that at your age, he chuckled. But then you find out moodiness can be a real drag in the real world.
Moodiness. Typical priest. Say 3 Hail Marys, the sin's gone. Smile and the pain's gone. The real world. As if he had the slightest idea what it was all about.
Is it that obvious?
What?
She asked, thinking she had missed something he'd said.
That I'm a jerk? It's okay. I mean, I know I am. I just usually do a better job of hiding it, that's all.
She smiled weakly, then looked out the side window. The winding road carried them past tidy farmhouses and weathered barns. Cows stood swishing their tails in scorched, hummocky pastures. This might be the day it finally rained. The sky was low and gray. Father Gannon lit a cigarette, then stepped down on the accelerator as the mountain's climb gave way now to a brief stretch of straight road.
You don't want to be here, do you?
He called over the motor.
Not really.
Your mother didn't seem too happy about the idea either.
He put his cigarette in the ashtray. Smoke drifted into her face.
I could tell she was upset.
It wasn't about that.
She fanned away the smoke.
Well, that's good.
He picked up his cigarette and smoked the rest in silence. A few minutes later, he looked over at her.
So where's that, that Homa from? Sounds like the South.
I guess so.
What's he do for work?
I don't know. Some kind of salesman or something.
Does he live in town?
Yeah.
She stared at him. He wanted her to say, he lives with us now, sleeps on our divorced mother's couch, and uses our divorced mother's bathroom.
What's he sell?
Soap.
Seems like a nice enough guy.
He flushed under her scrutiny.
He's my mother's boyfriend.
She wanted to shock him, but the word made her squirm. Her face was red.
Does that bother you?
No, why should it?
She folded her arms and crossed her legs. She wiggled her foot up and down.
It shouldn't. Not if you like him. I guess your mother's entitled to a little companionship, right? She must get awfully lonely sometimes.
She kept her eyes straight ahead. The sun had broken through, miraging the asphalt with puddles of light. At Applegate, Alice flipped through a magazine as she waited for her father in the solarium. It was 12:30, and Father Gannon would be back at 1. She was feeling more and more uneasy. Why hadn't her father come down by now? What had he been doing for the last half hour? The head nurse said he was in his room. He had been called. He knew she was down here. She squirmed in her seat and put down the magazine. The nurse smiled quizzically from her glass cubicle. With her eyes on Alice, she pushed one of the buttons on her console and spoke into the microphone. She held up a finger, nodding to indicate that he would be right down. The French doors from the stone patio were opened by a haggard woman in a violet robe. She leaned against the door frame and removed her velvet slippers, then folded them carefully into her pocket before stepping inside. Her toenails were painted red. She patted her long gray hair and stole a look at the nurse, who hadn't seen her yet.
"Is it lunch now?"
the woman asked, sitting in the chair next to her. "I don't know," Alice said, picking up the magazine again and pretending to read. The woman rocked silently. She curled her painted toes into the light carpet, then rubbed them together.
"The president sends me this polish,"
the woman whispered, exposing teeth as gray as her hair.
"Really?"
Alice locked her gaze on the elevator door.
"I saw him at a party once. He made the orchestra play Ain't She Sweet."
"Oh."
"I was 7 then. I used to hide in his garden when we went to visit, and nobody could find me."
She giggled into her hand.
"It was a magic garden, and these little tiny men used to take my clothes off. They ever do that to you?"
The woman cocked her head. "No." She cleared her throat. A bell rang. A man was laughing in another room. Someone began to play chopsticks on a tinny piano. An attendant passed through the solarium and into the next room where the piano was playing. The woman's shoulders hunched in gleeful anticipation.
"It's Marlin," she whispered.
Her eyes narrowed as the attendant led a blonde man in a red plaid shirt into the room. The attendant told Marlin to sit and wait for the lunch bell with the others. He meant her, Alice realized. She was one of the others.
"What's for lunch today?"
the woman called as the attendant went down the hall.
"Finn and Hattie in cream sauce,"
he answered without looking back. The woman clapped her hands and stamped her feet.
"I love Finn and Hattie in cream sauce,"
she squealed.
"I hate Finn and Hattie in cream sauce,"
Marlin snapped in a reedy voice.
"Who asked you?"
the woman spat.
"You never like anything nice anyway."
She leaned close to Alice.
"Want to know something Marlin really likes? I don't like you, dirty old fart."
Marlin turned huffily away.
"Marlin likes little boys,"
she whispered in a girlish, taunting voice.
"Marlin likes little boys. Marlin likes little boys. And that's why Marlin's here."
Marlin rolled his eyes and shrugged.
"What's your name?"
he asked, peering at Alice.
"My name is Dr. Leonard,"
he said when she told him hers.
"He's lying to you,"
the woman said. Marlin laughed politely.
"Actually, my name is Leonard Doctor."
"Liar,"
the woman said.
"His name is Marlin Ray, and he's been here almost as long as I have."
Marlin rolled his eyes and sighed.
"Are you a Democrat or a Republican?"
he asked, as if these were questions on a practiced list, just formalities. It was vital they be asked, though the answers seemed of little consequence or interest to him. He waited, blinking, when she hesitated.
"Democrat, I guess," Alice said. "I'm not sure. I've never..."
"Where do you live?"
"What do you care?"
the woman hissed at him.
"Don't tell him,"
she warned Alice.
"Where do you live?"
he repeated, pursing his lips impatiently.
"In Vermont."
She turned the pages, frowning, as if she were looking for something. The elevator door whirred open. Her father came toward her, carrying a small flat box. He wore a gray suit she had never seen before, the jacket too wide on his thin frame, the pants short and boxy. His red tie was bright and shiny. His slicked back hair was still wet. He squinted in the solarium's brightness.
He bent to kiss the top of her head, and she could almost taste his cologne.
"Welcome to my nut house," he said. "I see you've already met Marlin and Miss Getchell. They're both longtime members of the staff here," he said, winking.
Miss Getchell sat rigidly in her chair, head cocked, trying to hear their conversation. He grinned as he handed Alice the box.
"You don't have to open it now. Just a little something I made in crafts."
He had her get up and sit in the corner, away from the two patients.
"I do leather work. I signed up for it because I've gotten so good."
He laughed nervously.
"You know, after being up at Waterbury so many times."
He laughed again.
"After I get my master's in leather work, I've been accepted in their doctoral program here in beading."
He paused, and she knew he could see how close to tears she was. He sighed.
"Pet, I'm sorry you had to wait so long. I was trying to get a tie off somebody, you know, one that'd go with a suit. Like it? The guy up on 3 choked to death last week, and one of the orderlies is a buddy of mine, so..."
"Is that what you've been doing all this time, Daddy? Trying to find a tie?" She felt numb.
"I wanted to look nice for you. Better than the last time you saw me, anyway."
He hung his head.
"I'm sorry about graduation night, Pet. I can't get that out of my head."
When he looked up, his eyes were raw.
"What can I say? How the heck can I make something like that up to you?"
He squeezed her hand.
"Forgive your old man, huh? Because I'm going to make it up to you, I promise. As soon as I get my walking papers out of here, I'm getting a job and then I'm moving out of Helen's, believe it or not. Don't laugh, it's true. I'm coming off the bench and into the ball game. You should see my room. I've got all these lists of everything I have to do, all the people I have to make things up to. And top of the list, babe, is you. I mean that."
He grinned.
"I'm going to get a good job. Of course, the work might not be as skilled as my last job when I was a diamond cutter."
He looked at her expectantly.
"When was that?"
She couldn't believe he would spend the few minutes that were left telling old jokes.
"The summer I cut the grass at the ball field, remember? I was a diamond cutter."
She nodded and forced a smile. He seemed relieved.
"I gotta tell you this funny story. You're gonna like this one. There were these two old guys and..."
"Daddy,"
she interrupted, "Mom wants me to remind you that I'm starting college pretty soon, and it's going to cost an awful lot, and I really need your help."
"I know, Pet, but don't you see? First, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get this job thing lined up. I've got to find a place to live. I've got all these things to do, and here I sit."
He held up his hands in disgust.
"Day after day, doing nothing."
"Mom says there's a trust, that there's money Nana put aside."
"I know. She's got this idea in her head. All of a sudden, she thinks there's all this money. So you've got to tell her, Pet. Tell her if there is any money, it couldn't be much. Just about every penny's gone into Nana's care."
"Yes, but she said..."
"What about you now, Alice?"
he asked in the stern, fatherly tone she'd seldom ever heard.
"Are you working as hard as you can and saving your money? You know, when you get to be a certain age, you really can't keep coming to your parents all the time for help. Look," he said, pulling a slip of paper from his pocket. "Here, read this."
"I will be a man among men, and no longer a dreamer among shadows. Henceforth be mine a life of action and reality. I will work in my own sphere, nor wish it other than it is. This alone is health and happiness. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow."
"That's nice."
She handed it back, feeling empty and dazed.
"Would you like a copy? Wait, I'll get some paper and a pen, and I'll do it right now."
Before she could say anything, he was at the nurse's booth, tapping on the glass. He sat back down, and while he copied the saying onto the Applegate Hospital memo sheet, she tried again to explain how badly she needed money for school.
"Here,"
he interrupted, giving her the copy.
"Whenever you're feeling a little shaky, just read this. It helps," he said,
squeezing her arm, his voice trembling as if he'd just passed on the solution to all her problems.
"It really does."
A tall woman in Indian moccasins slipped past the nurse's station. She stood in the hallway, sniffing at the closed door.
"That's the one who keeps imaginary cats in her room,"
her father whispered. His pleasure in telling the story to her now, here, in such detail, was more devastating, more painful, than if he'd been roaring drunk.
Every day, he said, the woman pestered the orderlies to bring her cat food for her cats. Finally, after enough refusals, she figured out a way to convince them she wasn't hallucinating. She would urinate on the floor and blame it on the cats when the orderlies came in to clean it up. They ignored her. So then she began to defecate on the floor and blame that on the cats. The orderlies cleaned it up, and still they ignored her. So then one day in the garden she caught 3 mice and killed them. She put the dead mice in her room and told the orderlies that her cats had caught them. The orderlies decided to teach her a lesson. They left the dead mice in the room. When they went in the next morning, the mice were gone.
"What happened to the 3 mice?" they asked her. "The cats ate them," she said. "I told you they were hungry."
Her father chuckled and shook his head.
"Can you believe it? She ate the mice. So now they've got a whole new problem on their hands. It's the darndest thing, but they say she's quite a mouser."
He laughed, looking anxiously for her to join in. She tried to smile. He sighed with an uneasy glance at the people lining up behind the woman in Indian moccasins. The lunch bell rang, and as the doors opened into the dining room, the line surged forward. Miss Getchell put on her slippers and hurried into the dining room.
"All they think about around here is food," he said as the faint odor of smoked fish drifted in from the hallway.
He kept glancing toward the dining room. All the way up here she'd told herself to expect nothing, that it was just a visit, something she had to do, when in truth she had expected something, that he had finally seen the light, that for her, because of her love and devotion, because she had written, because she cared enough to come, he would repent and see that this one constant child, this chaste forgiver of his lies, this thirsty tongue lapping at his spilled and reckless love, could save him. But he didn't care. He wanted her to go. He wanted to be released. He wanted her to leave.
"I'd better get in there. If I miss lunch," he said, squeezing her hand for emphasis, "then I won't be able to eat again until dinner."
She laughed. She couldn't help it. "That's all right." She got up. Her legs felt shaky. He fidgeted with his tie.
"You could wait. What if you wait here while I eat? I didn't realize you'd be here at lunchtime, and now it's too late to get a guest pass. Can you wait?"
"No, the priest is coming." He couldn't hide his relief.
"Here, don't forget this," he said, handing her the box as he walked her to the door.
Marlin watched from his chair.
"When you get back, pet, go see Aunt Helen. She has to get me out of here. My 30 days are already up, and I'm still here. This isn't the same as the state hospital. The only way I can leave here is if she tells them to let me out. Will you do that for me, pet?"
Nodding, she tried to smile.
"Will you?"
her father pressed. She had to help him, he insisted. Of all the people he had written to, not one had lifted a finger to help him. She was his only hope. "But what'll I tell Mom about the money for school?" she asked, the ravenous claws opening slowly, slowly in her chest. His only hope, this dutiful child. What would he promise? What would he give in return?
"Don't you understand? That's why I have to get out."
He gripped her shoulders.
"What can I do in here? I can't start putting my life together until I'm out. Will you help me? Will you go see your Aunt Helen?"
Just then the intercom sputtered on, consuming her father's pleas in the staticky announcement of the afternoon's croquet tournament.
"You help me,"
screamed a voice in her head.
"I'm the child. I'm the child. Me." "She had no right to send me here," he continued when the intercom clicked off. "But don't tell her I said that. No sense in aggravating her any more than she is."
His fingers dug into her bones.
"What is it? Why are you crying?"
He was astonished. "I don't know. I'm just tired, I guess." She turned her head, wiped her eyes. "I get home from work so late, and then this morning there was all this commotion. Norm got in trouble, and that dog Benji likes is dead, and Mom was all upset, and the priest came, and Omar Duval was there." She looked at him. "He's always there."
"Shh,"
he said, pressing his stained finger to her lips. She could smell the tobacco. He had even smoked a cigarette, probably 2 or 3 or 4, while she had been waiting for him.
"Look, you go see Aunt Helen. That's the first thing that has to be done."
He glanced back. People were already leaving the dining room. He kissed her forehead.
I've got to run, pet, and grab whatever's left. You write now,
he called, waving as he edged into the dining room.
Write and tell me what Aunt Helen says.
She turned with a gasp at the light tapping on her shoulder.
Excuse me, Marlin said, batting short gray eyelashes. Where in Vermont do you live?
Father Gannon found Alice walking down the road to the main gate. It had just begun to sprinkle. When he apologized for being late, she said she had left early. They rode silently in the car's heat. Even with the window down, the air barely stirred. He drove deliberately, studiously, leaning forward, turning, squinting to appraise every sign and intersection, as if the success of their journey hinged on each passing landmark. He smoked with the same intensity, taking such long, deep drags that the cigarette was burning his lips. He asked about her visit. It was all right, she answered in a flat voice. Just all right. She was tired, she said, turning her head to the side window. His sweaty hands grew slick on the wheel. Squirming, he sniffed, wondering with alarm if she could smell his body secreting the fluids he'd never been able to mask with scent or cleanse away. Twice daily he showered. He used the best deodorants and most expensive colognes. The bishop had opened the windows before sitting down at his desk.
It's not for you to decide,
the bishop had said, fanning himself with Father Gannon's request for transfer.
You write in here of needs, spiritual needs, moral needs. You go on and on and on, citing example after example. What makes you so certain these same needs don't exist in Atkinson as well?
They don't. It's not the same, was all he could answer.
What's not the same?
The bishop had sighed with a frown that wrinkled his deep tan. He was a handsome man, dazzling eyes, silver hair, square-jawed. Before becoming a priest, he had been an actor. Some people said he still was.
Everywhere sin is the same, and greed is the same, and poverty and despair and death. These are the same. Only the places, young man, are different, and the faces. No, not even the faces.
The bishop leaned over the inlaid desktop.
After you've been a priest for as many years as I have, you will notice that the faces begin to be the same ones hour after hour, year after year. And this will wear you down some days to the bone, to the very marrow of your being. But on other days, you will understand that everywhere for everyone life is sorrowful. You must minister to all these needs in all these places.
He sat back, smiling patiently, basking in his own eloquence as he stroked his cheek with his ringed hand.
Your ministry, Father Gannon, is wherever you are assigned. Accept that reality now, while you're still young and pliable. Be patient.
But don't you see, Your Excellency? It's because I'm young that I know I can help more where I was than at St. Mary's. In New York, there were people who had come to me at the rectory for milk for their children, for their babies. Some of them had no decent shoes, no blankets.
Blankets,
the bishop cried, throwing up his elegant hands.
Blankets. It's blankets that I hear all the time about you, Father Gannon. Blankets and little boys' jackets. Will you forget all that and just get yourself back on track? Please, please, please.
Clasping his hands to his dimpled chin, he whispered,
"And now I am tired of this whole sophomoric discussion. You will remain in your present assignment until the provincial sees fit to transfer you."
"But you don't understand," he said.
And at that, the bishop stood up, his face curdling with annoyance.
"A bit of advice, Father Gannon," he said sharply. "You have already strained my desire to be understanding. And now the Monsignor tells me you strain his daily. The Monsignor is a very valuable man to me, and I won't have him upset just because you don't think you can set the world on fire in Atkinson, Vermont. To be priestly, Father, is first to learn obedience. And I might remind you, humility."
The bishop stalked out, his cassock swishing through the closing door. Humility. If he was nothing else, he was at least humble. The proof? This very trip. This sullen schoolgirl, too immersed in her adolescent gloom to even speak to him, much less show any gratitude. All at once, sheets of rain draped the windshield. The wipers were useless. The car sluiced through puddles that sprayed the top of the roof. Alice sat forward. "It's really bad," she said, looking at him.
"It's coming heavier, too," he called.
The torrent of rain beat on the roof. He leaned over the wheel.
"I can hardly see. I think there's a restaurant up there."
He braked, and the car shimmied, its wet engine sputtering. "No, it's just an old shack or something," she called, her face pressed to the side window. "Keep going."
"But I can't see anything. I have to stop here," he shouted, pulling off the road.
A buckled Coca-Cola sign dangled over the door of the boarded-up store. He ran his hands along the wheel. Rain poured down the windshield.
"What a waste of time," he sighed.
Hour after hour, the bishop had said, year after year. "I wish I'd never come," she said, twisting the handle on her purse.
"So do I," he said.
He thought he heard her gasp, then saw that she was crying.
"Oh, I didn't mean that the way it sounded. I didn't mean you," he tried to explain. "Come on, don't cry."
He raised his hand, then dropped it awkwardly on the seat between them.
"It was the bishop. I had a hard time, that's all. I meant that I shouldn't have gone up there to see him the way I did. That's all I meant."
"I know what you meant," she sniffed. He looked at her a moment.
"Was it your father? It wasn't a good visit, was it? It was a lousy visit. I'm sorry. Blame me. I shouldn't have interfered. Alice? Alice, please don't cry."
He tried to make her laugh.
"You can't do this to me, Miss Vermoyle. I never had this course at the seminary. I was flunking Latin, so they wouldn't let me take it."
She hunched against the door, trying not to cry. He tapped her arm.
"Want to know what the name of the course was? They called it Human Relations 2, or What to Do When a Young Lady Cries in the Monsignor's Car on a Lonely Road in a Downpour in the Middle of Nowhere, and you don't know what to say. Please smile. Please."
"Are you hungry?" he asked, opening the glove compartment.
"I just happened to have this emergency donut here."
He held it up, slimy and shriveled now that its sugar had melted.
"Every good priest carries one."
"It looks so disgusting," she blurted with a teary laugh, then covered her face and began to cry again.
"Ah, you might as well. Go ahead. Just like the rain, when it's over, everything'll look new again," he said softly,
then sat there with his arm over the back of the seat. But the more she cried, the more helpless he began to feel. How many times had words failed? And yet it was all he had. Words and prayers, his only tools from parish to parish. Words and prayers. When had they ever been enough? Jesus had beckoned the children to his side, then reached out and held them. The bishop thought he wanted to set the world on fire when all the time, every waking moment, it was himself that was on fire. His arms slid to her shoulder. "No," she said, as he pried her fingers from her face, then lifted her wet chin. She would not look at him. He could smell her mouth, her hair, the sweat on her neck.
"It's okay. It's okay," he whispered, pulling her closer.
He was conscious of the shallow flutter of her breathing at his ribs.
"There. There now," he said,
touching her wet eyelids, her nose, her cheekbones, her mouth, her soft mouth, her chin, her throat. The rain beat over the car. Careful. He would be so careful. See? She had stopped crying. That's all it took. He traced circles around her closed eyes, and then he kissed her. She sat wedged between the door and the seat, saying nothing, arms at her sides, unresisting. Rigid, he realized with a start.
"Alice."
Her eyes opened wide with a shock that sickened him.
"Alice, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
It wasn't until he moved behind the wheel that she sat up and smoothed her skirt over her knees.
"Alice, please look at me."
She did, and he wished she hadn't. She looked so cold and angry.
"I mean it. I'm really sorry."
"I thought you'd be," she said, with a brusqueness that made him feel worse.
"You mean you saved me from myself? Is that it?
He said with a bitter laugh. She flushed, and it was all he could do to keep from touching her soft, warm cheek.
I didn't want to embarrass you, she said stiffly.
Embarrassed? I'm not embarrassed, Alice. I'm ashamed. You're the one that's been embarrassed. You are, aren't you?
She shook her head yes as she toyed with her purse.
Oh, my God.
He sighed with a bitter laugh, and her head shot up.
I don't think this is very funny, Father. I don't know what I'm supposed to say now or what I'm supposed to do.
She looked as if she were about to cry again.
I don't either.
He hit the wheel and groaned.
God, what a fool I am. What a stupid, stupid fool.
I think it's letting up a little, she said, staring at the windshield.
Her mother followed her into her room and sat on her bed while she dressed for work.
How does he look?
Her mother asked. She turned her back as she stepped out of her dress.
He looks okay.
She threw the damp, wrinkled dress onto the bed, annoyed not to have even a few moments of privacy. She felt sweaty and soiled, as if there were handprints all over her body. Father Gannon had barely spoken on the trip back. By the time they got to Atkinson, his eyes were heavy and hooded, and he was hunched over the wheel, gripping it with both hands, his misery so pervasive that she had gotten out of the car feeling guilty, convinced that by letting the mask slip, by losing control, she had tempted him.
Is he better?
Her mother asked.
I guess so.
You guess so? Well, is he or isn't he? Was he shaky?
He's sober, she answered.
Well, what did he say about the money?
Not much, she said, slipping her uniform pants up under her slip. What do you mean, not much?
Her mother's mouth was thin and white.
He said he had to get out first, that he'd take care of all that when he got out.
Damn it, her mother scowled up at her. And you just let it go at that, like it didn't even matter? What the hell's wrong with you? Where in God's name do you think that money's coming from, I ask you? She pounded her fist into her palm.
Don't blame me. I tried. I went up there with that weird priest. I didn't want to, but I went. And then I had to sit and wait for most of the hour with all these crazy people talking to me. And then when Daddy finally came, all he talked about was lunch and getting Aunt Helen to let him out of there. And he told a few jokes, and then he couldn't wait to get away from me. Here, she said, tossing the slip of paper and the box into her mother's lap. That's all I got out of him, and now I'm tired and I'm hungry and I've got to get ready for work.
Her mother read the saying, then looked down at the wallet he had tooled, the edging he had laced. She closed her eyes.
That bastard. That no-good bastard.
Just as the first lights dimmed in the lot, a long black Oldsmobile pulled into Alice's station. She was shocked to see Father Gannon, red-eyed, his pale face shadowed with stubble. He asked if they could talk for a few minutes. She explained that she had to help close up now, but he offered to wait and give her a ride home. She told him she already had a ride. What she did not say was that it would be Omar Duval, because Norm had been grounded and her mother's car still smelled. Never again would there be a personal word between them.
I really have to talk to you, he said. I need to explain.
His voice broke off as Mr. Coughlin approached the car.
Hey, come on, let's get a move on here,
Coughlin called with a jerky wave. It was said that by summer's end, Coughlin was always in a state of nervous collapse.
Save the chit-chat for later, on your own time,
he bellowed, then raced into his office. Blue Mooney had just pulled in to pick up Anthology. Arms folded, he leaned against his car, talking to Fawny Anuta, a tiny black-haired girl with feline eyes. She was so obsessed with Mooney that she had taken to pumping Alice for information about herself that she could pass on to him. Looking at Alice, Mooney said something and Fawny shrugged.
I have to go, Alice said. This was so awkward.
The priest kept rubbing some invisible spot on the door leather. She stepped back and he looked up.
I have to straighten this out.
That's okay, she said.
No, I need to explain it, he said. I'm just so worried about the effect this could have.
I'd never say anything, honestly.
That would be the last thing she'd ever do. He closed his eyes and sighed.
I meant the effect on you, Alice. The effect of my poor judgment.
please, give me the opportunity to make this right. I beg you, please.
Coughlin opened his door and yelled for her to start cleaning up so everyone wouldn't be stuck here all night.
Father, I have to go. I really do.
Tomorrow, then, he said.
Tomorrow was her day off.
Sometime next week, then.
He'd come by at closing and give her a ride home, he called as she hurried into the kitchen. When he showed up, she would say she'd forgotten that her brother was on his way. She was scrubbing trays when Blue Mooney strutted into the kitchen. He wore his uniform pants and a white T-shirt. He grabbed a towel and picked up a wet tray. She worked with her head down, determined to ignore him. She could feel him watching her over the tray he kept drying. He was a pervert like his cousin Anthology and Coughlin, just waiting for the car hops to leave so they could drink and look at their filthy pictures.
You're real quiet tonight. You tired?
Yeah.
Long day, huh?
Yeah.
You look tired. Hey, I could finish this up so you can leave. I gotta wait anyway.
No, that's okay, but thanks.
She held her breath. Would this, the longest, strangest day of her life, ever end?
That guy out there, the one that just left, was he bothering you?
No.
You didn't look too happy, he said.
He rubbed the tray as he followed her between the sink and the dirty stack at the order window.
Something about him, I don't know. You know how you can tell about a person sometimes? You know what I mean?
He asked, right on her heels as she went back to the sink.
Uh-huh,
she said, scrubbing furiously, as if this dull brown plastic required all of her attention.
Some people you just get certain feelings about, he said.
His toweled hand